Veritex Community Bank Studios. ESPN 97.5 and 92.5 proudly present The Killer Bees.
Definitely a fan of The Killer Bees.
Now bringing you the fastest 3 hours in Houston sports radio, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
What up, H-Town? Hey, how we doing?
He's Joel, I'm Jeremy. It is a Wednesday edition of The Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5. Astros victorious yesterday, and then the cool weather yesterday. How pleasant was it this morning to wake up and go outside and you don't immediately sweat and it's not 100 degrees?
Outstanding. No humidity in the 60s. Enjoyable to say the least. Now can we just keep it for a while?
Yeah, I'm hoping so. I'm hoping summer is gone officially. For the rest of the year. It felt great today. I'm a little upset that we're not doing an outside remote today. Astros get the victory over the Angels yesterday, 10-5. The A's lose again to Seattle. The magic number dropping to 5 and then 4 as soon as the Astros get the victory. Astros just cruising along right here in the AL West, and I think decision time now for the Astros is how active they are in chasing after the Tampa Bay Rays. Because Tampa Bay lost yesterday to Toronto as well. So the Astros only 2.5 back. They play the Rays in a 3-game series coming up in the final homestand. The Astros control their destiny for the top spot in the American League.
It's a beautiful thing. I've been telling you all along, if they can keep it in and around 3 before that series with the Rays at the end of the season, then you have to pay attention to it because you want to control your own destiny. You want to figure out the best matchup and be in a position that if you want to go for it, you go for it. And if you want to just mail it in without literally admitting you're mailing it in, and Dusty has a way of doing that anyway by sitting good players, playing your bench players, not pitching your starters too deep because you know you'd rather play the White Sox than the winner of the wild card, you do that. But you want to be in a position of strength, and right now the Astros are in a deep position of strength. Coming from where they were 2 weeks ago or so when we were like, man, I don't know what they're doing, and now the division is basically being in question. Magic number down to 4. You've won 6 of the last 7. The bats are on fire. The starting pitching is doing what they always have just needed to do. Just get you 5+. And Urquidy did that. And then he faced a little bit of a danger zone. But when they keep playing the way they're playing and now taking care of opponents they're supposed to take care of, that is a position of strength. And they're warming up at the right time. You want this team to be hot at the hottest time of the year? That's what they're doing right now.
A little bit of moxie. You can see that with the Astros as well. Martin Maldonado, how about him hitting home runs in back-to-back days?
Where'd that come from?
I don't know. But it's nice because now you don't have a black hole in that ninth spot. So it kind of turns the lineup over for everybody. But the Astros exploding yesterday. Jose Urquidy got the start. I thought he was solid. 4 runs, 6 hits, and 5 1/3. Didn't make it out of the 6th inning and ended up throwing 79 pitches. Here's what Dusty Baker had to say about the performance of his starter.
Yeah, I mean, he was great except just give a couple home run balls. And then we're trying to get him to the 6th to build up his endurance. And then he, hung a couple breaking balls and led 3 runs. And that's why we had to go get him. But he was very good up to that point.
I'm going to give Urquidy a pass there in the 6th inning, and the reason why, the Astros had a long inning in the 5th scoring 4 runs. They had a long inning in the 6th scoring 3 runs. I'm giving Urquidy a bit of a pass for that 6th inning where, he hung a pitch, got knocked out of the park. I thought he was sharp, and to me, again, just solidifying my stance on him to where he's one of my top 3 starting pitchers if I'm making a playoff rotation power ranking. That doesn't necessarily mean I need him to start game 3, because if I need him in game 1 or 2, I would go there. But he's in that top 3 for me in terms of starting pitcher.
Not for me.
In the playoffs.
Not for me. Simply because as much as I like the way he got out of the box and he was pitching early, aside from 1 long ball, as Dusty said, when he starts to lose control of his breaking pitches, he's a different pitcher. And so with that, I have to give Greinke the benefit of the doubt. And that's why these starts down the stretch are going to be so important. Because I want to see both of them pitch now down the stretch. One or two more starts so I can determine from an Urquidy standpoint, was that just a flash in the pan kind of thing with the breaking pitches? And are you capable of overcoming that? It's not going to be a regular thing. And with Greinke, I just need to know what I have. I mean, I need to know that if you can get back to the Greinke that for most of the season was a guy that was getting wins and wasn't overpowering anybody, was pitching, not just throwing, was smart, and knew how to strategically get through 5-6 innings and keep you in ball games, then it's going to be a two-headed horse race, and it's still to be determined because I can't shut the door on Zach Greinke because I've seen too much of him, including in the World Series, to know that in the playoffs, he can be special, and that's something that you have to consider.
Look, it's fair to say that there's been recency bias with Zach Greinke. His last three starts have been abysmal. We talked about the numbers, an ERA of about 12 in those three starts, two of them coming off of COVID. So he's trying to bounce back, right, trying to find that rhythm. And that speaks to your point where let's see what he does the next couple of trips in the rotation. But for me, it's not a conversation. Like, if Greinke's making a playoff start, he's not making that playoff start over a fully rested Jose Urquidy. If he's making a playoff start, for me, it's because he's getting the start over Luis Garcia. I don't even feel like Urquidy's like in that conversation or in that debate. I think the debate comes down to Luis Garcia, Zach Greinke, and probably to a lesser extent, the dark horse, Jake Odorizzi.
So I don't know how you do that. You've completely elevated Urquidy over even Luis Garcia, and I don't understand that because Garcia's been hot, and Garcia's done a lot of great things this year too. And again, you completely are just looking past the fact that from an experienced veteran standpoint, been there, done that, and done it well. Zach Greinke's a guy that's got that all on his resume, and the only thing we're worried about is the fact that he lost his lost gas and lost juice because of the fact that he had COVID. It's just, we talk about all the time, how long each individual takes to recover from it is different. If this is going to be a lingering thing with him, then it's a problem and I can see it your way. If it's not, I can't look past Zach Greinke because I know of all my staff, aside from maybe McCullers and even more so from an overall longevity of his career standpoint of experience in the playoffs, Zach Greinke's a guy that Dusty, especially knowing how Dusty plays hunches and how he loves veterans, I don't know how you can turn your back on Zach Greinke and not think that this is a guy that could play an important role in your playoff push.
Well, I'm not saying that. I could still see him very likely being the number four starter on this team and being a part of the playoff rotation. I'm just not elevating him over Jose Urquidy, especially from the Jose Urquidy I saw yesterday. I thought Jose Urquidy was really sharp until that last inning, yeah, but those are two long half innings. I mean, the Astros scored four in the fifth, three in the sixth. It's easy to kind of wear down. And also, you kind of lose focus there, too, I think, as a starting pitcher. The Astros were up 10-1 entering the bottom of the sixth inning. A pitcher at that point just saying, all right, I'm going to throw a couple pitches over the plate. If you hit them, you hit them. I'm not going to walk anybody. So it changes that mentality and it changes the approach of a starter. I also think we're sleeping on the playoff experience of Jose Urquidy too. Jose Urquidy's pitched in eight playoff games. He's pitched in two World Series games and has been pretty sharp in both of them. Game four of the 19 World Series, five shutout innings. Like, Urquidy's been nails in the postseason. And in fact, he's got a much better postseason ERA than Zach Greinke. And I'm not trying to crap on Zach Greinke. I think Greinke still could have a pivotal, you know, role in this playoff team or in this playoff race for the Astros and into the postseason. But he also has to pitch better. If you cannot rely on Zach Greinke, he's given up four or five runs every time he pitches.
No, I agree with that. But I also think that we talk about sample sizes all the time, and it all started with Brock Osweiler, but it relates easily to baseball as well. And you can give me all the numbers you want on Urquidy in a very small sample size. And look, I'm not crapping on Urquidy because I believe he is a key to this team going long and deep into the playoffs because he can be a huge factor. But I'm not willing to do that and then also say as a spinoff of that I'm going to turn my back on Zach Greinke because Greinke is almost, if not more important to this rotation. You know what you have in Urquidy. He's younger, he throws harder, and he's going to be around for a while. You know from a Greinke standpoint, this is it for him, probably with the Astros, but what he's given you since he's been an Astro has been big, and because he's been with some bad teams and in the playoffs sometimes when he was with the Brewers, he was with the Royals for a long time, the Dodgers stint, those weren't the same kind of teams as he's on now. When he's got a great defense behind him and he's got good offense behind him, he's a guy that really can be a factor for a true World Series contender, and that's why I like having both of these guys in this discussion. I wouldn't turn my back on either one of them, but it definitely is a game changer if they both bring their A game because now you're at the luxury of being able to fill some of your bullpen spots with some of your better spot starters through in the year and do some of the things we said by splitting games up between two of the other starters, Odorizzi, Garcia, Javier, those kind of guys can actually fill the role of in the 4-5 slot or the 5 slot and in the bullpen.
Yeah, it's a good problem to have. Who are you riding with? Who do you have more trust in the playoffs, Jose Urquidy or Zach Greinke? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. And I don't think the Astros are going to be in a position where they're naming Game 3 and Game 4 starters before they even make that trip. Like, they're going to have home field advantage. Games 1 and 2 of an ALDS are going to be at home. You're going to have that travel day on the day off. That's when the Astros are going to determine who's pitching in Game 3 and Game 4. Because if you're in a spot where you need to use Luis Garcia, if you're in a spot where you need to use Jose Urquidy, if it's like a game that goes into extra innings, or it's a game where Fromber is just off and doesn't have command and you're scoring lots of runs, you would turn to those guys in those spots. So it's not as simple as just 1 through 4, here are your starting pitchers and roll them out there. I mean, they're going to have to manage games 1 and 2. Of course, Dusty Baker doing that. We mentioned the magic number down to 4. Mariners beat the A's. There was more people in Bricktown to watch the OKC Dodgers in Round Rock last night than the A's and Mariners. It's an embarrassment. I am ready for the Oakland A's to move to Las Vegas. I know that there's things in the works, and it can't happen for a few years, but I would love for it to happen immediately, because that's an embarrassment to what is, what has been, a good franchise in Major League Baseball.
Well, and they keep talking about, you know, the other one that I bring into the equation is Tampa. Tampa wants to be title town, and they're talking about because of the Lightning and the Buccaneers and the Rays. Well, you got to support your town there, too, and your team there, and I don't care if it's not physically in Tampa. You've got a winning team that if you truly believe is part of Title Town, you need to support them too. Just like in Oakland, you know, you were upset when the Warriors left, but the Warriors left a dump at Oracle, which is on the same property as the Coliseum where the A's play, which is the biggest dump in baseball, not named the Trop. And if you can't support the team, then nothing says that I should justify a new stadium for you and a new environment to keep it right where it's at. Warriors left for San Francisco, which is gorgeous and an ideal place. And don't think that the A's couldn't do that too. But I think like you, I could see the A's going to Vegas and being welcomed with open arms and be a huge success. I could see the Rays moving anywhere else in baseball. And there's Portland, there's Nashville, there's all these different cities that are dying for a Major League Baseball team. If you can't draw more than 5,000 fans for either a playoff team or a team contending for the wild card, and you say, oh, but when the playoffs start, we'll be there. No, your fair weather fandom could go right up Main Street and get the hell out of here. And I'm going to go someplace where I'm going to be supported 1 through 162. And if I make the playoffs, that's an embarrassment in both cities' case. And that's not something that baseball should take lightly.
Relegate them, move their city to give it to Oklahoma City, who's outdrawing Major League Baseball teams for a triple A game. Did you see the newest cheating scandal in Major League Baseball happened 2 nights ago? Blue Jays and the Rays in their series. There was a play at the plate. Kevin Kiermaier slid into the tag, but the catcher had like his little notepad come off from his little quarterback wrist, is what I call him. And then Kiermaier picked it up, and then the Blue Jays caught wind of this. They were chirping a little bit back and forth. Apparently, they hashed it out yesterday before the game, but he dropped the game plan, the catcher did, on how they were attacking these Rays hitters, and apparently the Blue Jays were really mad about it. Hey, if you don't want somebody stealing your game plan, maybe don't take it onto the field.
Well, and I think that, you know what, you talk about the integrity of the game, and baseball wanted to have the integrity of the game cleaned up with the Astros cheating scandal. It's part of the game, just like stealing signs has always been a part of the game. It's just what level, to what degree do you take it with technology and otherwise. But in the case of this being gamesmanship going on in the game of baseball, I mean, I don't think that I'm going to, Kiermaier, they put him in front of microphones, and he had to try and soft shoe it in terms of what he did and try to make it an accident. No, it wasn't. It wasn't an accident at all. If you look at the video, he saw what happened, and he clearly picked it up. And if a team can get an advantage, they're not going to apologize for it. They sent a bat boy over from the Blue Jays to go get it back, and basically the Rays scoffed at it and go, you're not getting it back. Like you said, if you're willing to put your game plan on a wristband, then you also have to be willing to deal with the consequences if you lose such wristband, or how everybody has their cheat cards for pitching and playing defense in their back pocket. It's part of the game. So I don't expect Major League Baseball to get involved and, like, throw the book at them or anything like that. What I do expect is, as you take it back to the Astros cheating scandal, start to realize more and more teams did this, have done this, are continuing to do this. It's part of the game of baseball. Deal with it, but don't deal with it by just punishing one team.
It is funny how paranoid teams get about the scouting reports and things like that, and like being around shoot-arounds and all grabbing the scouting report, when in all actuality, like, the other team usually has a pretty good idea of how you're going to defend them and how you're going to attack them. If you're a Major League Baseball hitter, you know what your weaknesses are. You know how you're being attacked. So I thought it was this huge story, this huge Twitter drama, when in actuality, I'm not sure how much of an advantage it really gains.
Teams make trades, right? Players leave in the middle of a season and go to another team. Football, you see it all the time where a guy gets cut and you're playing the team that cut him's team the next week and he gets picked up because they want the secrets. Look, there's going to be trades made and guys are going to go, you know, in our scouting report, this is where they said to pitch you. This are the pitches they said you can't hit. These are the pitches you like, blah, blah, blah. You have friends on other teams, whether they do it when you're obviously not when they're about to play your team, but everybody talks. So the word gets out, like you said. In the NBA, there used to be a scouting report the size of the Sears catalog for every game, and guys were expected to read it. Now it's all on DVDs or it's on, you know, computer programs that they're watching. But everybody gets wind of everything that is the scouting report for every player and every play in baseball, basketball, football, and otherwise.
All right, coming up next, Davis Mills making his first NFL start. What's the plan? It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
ESPN 97.5. Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
I just really like his maturity, and he'll feel comfortable going in the game. And we'll help him out in the game. We know he's a rookie quarterback, but we'll help him out, and we'll do things to make sure that all the other 10 guys around him are doing their job to be able to keep him upright and keep him comfortable.
David Culley speaking about his rookie quarterback, Davis Mills. He'll be making his first NFL start tomorrow night. I love that the Texans are playing on Thursday night, by the way. Like, just have it Thursday night. You can pay all your, because you can pay all your attention to it. Like, sometimes if they're on a Sunday, they get lost in the shuffle a little bit. Now, we have to watch every snap that they play, of course. But you want to watch the Red Zone channel. You want to watch the big game of the week. So, I know there's ways of doing both. But it's nice that you don't have anything to do on Thursday.
I mean, you need to catch up on technology then, because I can do two screens and record games, and I catch up whenever I need to.
Are you quoting me? Because
I'm just making sure that you're, you know, you're going to be up to speed soon with the show and what you need to do.
Okay, all right. Well, what do you do with a rookie?
It's their only national TV game of the year, and it's a Thursday night football game. I mean,
in week three.
The good news is it's not going to be the YouTube only game or something like that where they really could have buried him. But early in the season, before they really face the gauntlet and don't look so good, they thought they were going to get the best of the Texans, and then Taylor goes out, and you're like, okay, well, here we go.
Well, every NFL team has to have the primetime game, as you know, and as everybody knows. But I like it when the Texans are the primetime game. I like it when there's no other distractions around the league. And, yeah, it's Thursday nighter, and it's not this marquee matchup, and Thursday nighters are never as good as the Sunday nighters, and maybe even to a lesser extent the Monday nighters. But, yeah, I like it when the Texans are on in isolation. All right, rookie quarterback Davis Mills, first start. I think it's a benefit for Davis Mills that he played in the game against Cleveland, that he played the second half. I don't want to overreact to how Davis Mills looked in that second half. Like, he was thrown into the fire against a pretty good defense. I know I'm not this huge Davis Mills apologist, but I also think it was a really bad spot for a rookie. It's a quarterback that wasn't ready to play, had a terrible preseason, and then he's just thrown into the wolves against a pretty good Browns defense. And to his credit, look, he overall did not play a good game. It's safe to say that. That's not some hot take that Davis Mills didn't play well overall. But you could see some steady improvements from whenever he was in the third quarter and then into the fourth quarter and ended up having a pretty good touchdown drive there late in the game and kept the Texans competitive and into it. Now he has a semi-full week to prepare for this one. Kind of sucks. He only has until Thursday to get ready for it. But now this is whenever I think it's fair to grade what Davis Mills looks like as a rookie quarterback in the NFL.
I don't. And it's the least desirable position for a rookie quarterback to be in, because unlike all the other guys we've been talking about that were drafted in the first round that got, you know, all this publicity about whether they should be starting right away or not, and you can go right down the list from we knew Trevor Lawrence, but when you talk about Fields and Lance and all those guys, the thing is with Davis Mills, he's again behind the eight ball, because you've been practicing as the second-string quarterback, not getting any first-team reps, and really not getting prepared like all the other guys were from a week-to-week basis, and you get thrown into the fire midway through a game due to an injury. You would at least hope that the following week, when you know you're going to be the starter, you have a full week to prepare to do everything that you need to do and have ample time to really get situated. Instead, it's a short week, and you're thrown to the fire yet again. And you got to believe, as much as Tim Kelly would like to open up the playbook or keep it the same, he's going to have to dumb it down quite a bit with a Carolina defense that has, now that they've really grasped the system after a year, look like that they really know what they're doing and they're comfortable doing it. And that's unfortunate, because that's way more challenging than anything that all these other rookie quarterbacks are being faced with their teams.
You have to kind of sift through all the press conferences and all the media sound to like get some true like honesty from coaches. It's hard to find that at times. And like we heard that David Culley coming out of the commercial break. Like, there's some coach speak there. I thought Tim Kelly was a little bit more honest. Still some coach speak, but a little bit more honest on how they're going to have to handle Mills.
Yeah, I think anytime you have, you know, a different quarterback in the game, you're doing what you can to try to play to his strengths. So, you know, Davis done a good job since he's got here coming in and putting himself in a position to go out and hopefully make that transition seamlessly. And we're going to still do what we can to make sure we're putting him in a spot to be successful.
So there's a little honesty from Kelly, right? Like he's saying, look, every quarterback has a different skill set. Whereas David Culley's saying that, oh, yeah, our playbook's going to be the same. We're going to do the exact same stuff that we normally do with Tyrod Taylor or that we did with Tyrod Taylor through the first six quarters of the NFL season. Here you have the actual play caller saying, yeah, we're going to have to change things up to kind of match the skill set of Davis Mills as opposed to Tyrod Taylor, who's very different skill sets between the two.
Yeah. I mean, look, and like you said, I understand what you're saying. You got to read between the lines and all the press conferences to try to get something. But I still go back to what Brady said. They're not giving you anything. And these press conferences, they're basically pulling the wool over your eyes and giving the whole song and dance as much as possible. It's a challenge for both guys because as much as we were talking about yesterday, look, the backup quarterback, it doesn't have the same skill set as the starter. Whether it was Deshaun Watson in the years past or this season, you've got an athletic quarterback in Tyrod Taylor, and now you're going to a big, tall, different-sized, different-skill-setted quarterback in Davis Mills that's also raw as raw can get. So, I mean, they're going to tell you whatever they're going to tell you. I just think that both Kelly and Davis Mills are really going to be in an awkward position because their chances to succeed are slim. Their chances to fail and get killed for it are great, and it's not really on them because no one could have foreseen the injury, and no one knew that it was going to be at a time when you're on a short week and you don't have the same kind of time frames and schedules and practice times that could actually help this kid to do some good things. So the good part from the flip side is Carolina can't prepare for him because there's really not a whole lot of tape unless they want to watch Stanford film from a year ago. But you hope that they can try and put some wrinkles into the game plan between now and Thursday. You hope that he realizes to rely on his checkdowns and not try to do too much because this is the ultimate game manager situation for this kid.
Yeah, I mean, I think you want to run the ball like 40 times on Thursday against Carolina. Look, I think Carolina has enough film on him, to be honest with you. I mean, they saw the half that he had against Cleveland. I mean, he had to put things on display. I know they dumbed down the playbook, but I thought your point was a good one too. Short week. I mean, you're not going to put too much more onto his plate that he already had Sunday against Cleveland.
Yeah, I think even Cleveland knowing. Yep. Well, look, besides giving OBJ the game off, I think Cleveland dummied down a whole lot of stuff. I think
Kareem Hunt touched the ball 11 times. Yeah. Like, I mean, they almost gave him the day off.
Now, they'll never admit it, but it also helps them going forward because teams that they're going to play on their upcoming schedule don't have as much to focus on and expect from the wrinkles in their playbook. So I think that as much as Stefanski rolled the dice, and all coaches do when they take a team for granted, but they definitely took the Texans for granted so that they could keep some things in their back pocket. From a Texans perspective, the one drive is one where you look at it and go, look, I believe that he has the capabilities to game manage this team in the long term this season if he has to. I just don't know if you're going to get anything better than you got in that second half with the Browns tomorrow night. And that's scary to me.
Two games in, small sample. Carolina was facing the Saints last week who were down like half a dozen coaches and about half a dozen players. They do have the top defense in the NFL. One more from Davis or from Jake Delhomme. Jake Delhomme was on the Wheelhouse yesterday. He was great, by the way. Former Houston Texan legend, Jake Delhomme. He was talking about how he expects the Texans to try to make life a little easier for Davis Mills.
We'll actually have the same playbook. Obviously, there are some things that he is a...
That wasn't Jake Delhomme. We'll get to Jake Delhomme in a second, but just the fact that, hey, look, and I think to your point was a really good one, too. The fact that it's Thursday, like, I don't think we're going to see anything fancy from Davis Mills tomorrow night. Now, in 2 weeks, when you have 10 days to prepare, I think that's whenever you might have a chance to see a little bit more from Davis Mills than what we saw in the second half against Cleveland and what we'll see tomorrow night against Carolina. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, Tua Tagovailoa, some bad news for him if you're a Tua fantasy football owner. We'll go around the NFL as well. It's the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Yep.
ESPN
97.5.
Now back to the Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham.
Bad news if you're a Dolphins fan. Tua has broken ribs It came out today, Brian Flores announcing that today he is out for Sunday's game. So what does this mean? Deshaun Watson, back to my... I'm kidding. But bad news for Miami. Bad news for Miami, losing Tua. They also announced that they're expected to make some major changes to the offensive line, something that Dell's been telling us, that the offensive line was so bad, doesn't matter who's behind center. They're expected to make some wholesale changes ahead of Sunday's game against the red-hot Las Vegas Raiders.
Yeah, I mean, look, the good news is what we were talking about yesterday, which is the good teams that play it smart nowadays use the Nick Foles concept of one quarterback, just like one running back, isn't good enough anymore. And if you truly want to be good and know how dangerous and how violent the sport is of NFL football, you have to prepare just in case you lose one of your best skill players, and especially the quarterback. Jacoby Brissett, been there, done that with a couple of teams, started enough games that at least in the short term, until they can really diagnose Tua and know how long he's going to be out, have a guy that can at least fill the void and keep them in the running for a playoff spot. Texans obviously are in a different ballgame because they're not a playoff roster, and they're not looking at a playoff spot right now. And honestly, like we keep saying, I don't think Nick Caserio quietly, if he had a lie detector test, could tell you with a straight face that he wasn't trying to embrace the suck and be as bad as possible and get all the draft picks. Dolphins are different. They've got one of those guys. So they should be fine. But it does at least put it back on the radar from a Dolphins perspective, from the big picture standpoint of when all is said and done with Deshaun, they may still very well be at the top of the list in terms of contenders wanting to go get him.
Yeah, I think at some point there'll be a lot of teams that are interested in Deshaun Watson. I just don't think it's going to be anytime soon, like a lot of people think. It is the rib injuries are always kind of weird, too, because like Deshaun Watson played through one in a punctured lung. Like they asked Brian Flores today, is Tua going to go on the injured list? And nope, he's day-to-day. Now, Brian Flores, notorious for not giving away a lot of information. Why
Team
would you
Belichick.
Tip your hand? And Team Belichick. And the IR now is a lot more favorable to teams than it has been in the past. You only miss three games. You get unlimited returns. So you could store him away if you think he's going to miss 3 to 4 weeks. But day-to-day, and look, people have played through broken ribs before, so I don't think it's out of the question that Tua could be back next week or the week after. So maybe it doesn't make sense to put him on the IR.
No, and again, you are more of a sense of urgency if you're Brian Flores and the Dolphins, because as we said, your clock was sped up last year when the rebuild that was supposed to take years and years looked like that they were on a crash course to get back there even last year. So now they're a little bit more worried about every single game, every moment of time, because they know that the clock is ticking and they're going in the right direction quickly. But if something like this isn't handled correctly, they can also go in the opposite direction very quickly and fall bottoms out right out of it. That's why you don't want to put him on the injured list, and he has to miss a minimum of 3 weeks, because you don't know what you're going to get out of Brissett. He's been okay. At times with the Colts, he was good, but he's never been a guy that you'd look at and go, there's my franchise quarterback, or there's a guy that I believe for the next 5 to 10 years is going to lead my team. So you got to see what you got. And if you're lucky and the best case scenario is you get a Teddy Bridgewater with the Saints a couple years ago and you get a guy that picks up the offense and immediately keeps the football moving, gets first downs, gets you points, keeps you in games, doesn't lose you a game. But if he completely craps the bed and comes in and doesn't know what he's doing and starts coughing up the football and doing a lot of bad things, they might say to Tua, hey, we know that you might not be 100%, but we may need you a little bit more than we thought.
I think if it's Tua and he misses 2 weeks, you'd be happy to go 1-1 if you're Miami with your backup quarterback. I think any team in the league, if you're playing your backup quarterback and you could play 500 football, that's a victory. And I'm right there with you. I think Jacoby Brissett, as far as backup quarterbacks in the league go, I think he's not bad. You know, he's probably in the top half of backup quarterbacks around the NFL. We'll see what he does on Sunday with no Tua. Antonio Brown placed on the COVID list today for Tampa Bay. Looks like he's going to miss Sunday's. That's the best game of the weekend, I think. Tampa Bay and the L.A. Rams meeting up on Sunday. Tampa is going to be without Antonio Brown, one of their big pieces offensively. They have so many big pieces offensively, though. I don't think they're necessarily going to miss him for one game, but not expected to play this weekend as they place him on the COVID list.
Yeah, no. I mean, look, if it was a situation where it's like DK Metcalf was out for the Seahawks and they really don't have a whole lot else except for a deep threat on their roster, you'd be totally freaked out. But because, you know, Mike Evans, who on any other team would be your go-to number one A guy unequivocally.
Yep.
You've got Mike Evans. You know, you've got a stable of receivers that they found what Scotty Miller last year.
Godwin's a stud too.
And Godwin just got paid. So, and you got Gronk. And you
vintage Gronk, by the way, catching touchdowns left and right.
Yeah, a couple of them last week. So it's not like the Buccaneers are going to sit there and cry and spill milk going, you know, if we had them, we'd have a better chance against the Rams. No, they're going to be just fine. You just have to worry about the long-term ramifications as it relates to the rest of the team, because COVID means if one guy's got it, whether it's contact tracing, we saw what happened with the Saints a week ago, and then everybody scoffed at it. It wasn't any players, it was coaches. And then you realize how important coaches are on a game day and during the course of a game in making sure the plan's executed and everybody gets what they need. So you don't want this to be something that takes off, and in a firestorm, suddenly you got 8, 10, 12 staffers, coaches, and players involved in it from a Buccaneers perspective. But from a players on the field standpoint, it doesn't really affect them a whole lot.
Yeah, I'm not going to give. I'm not going to weight the Saints' loss last week to Carolina that
not completely.
Highly because not completely. It's still going to matter.
Right.
It's still going to be part of the equation. But I'm just not giving it as much weight as some of the other games around the league. I mean, coaching does matter. I thought Bomani Jones when he joined us yesterday. If he's to believe coaching matters, then yeah, that's a loss. Kevin Stefanski says he expects Odell Beckham to be a complete participant in practice. Looks like he'll play on Sunday. No Jarvis Landry, though, for Cleveland. So you lose one LSU receiver. You add another LSU receiver. Probably could have played last week against the Texans.
Should've.
But why risk it in a game that you should win? That's a smart business decision.
Absolutely. Like we said, if you're going to basically take it for granted, and most times it doesn't backfire. When it does, you've got hell to pay with the media and the fan base. But he did the smart move. And you're looking at, I believe they play the Bears this week. You're looking at a better defense, but more so than that, it's not about who they're playing this week as opposed to last week of the Texans. It's about because Landry's out, we don't have that stable of receivers with NFL experience like the Buccaneers do. So therefore, to make sure we don't miss a beat and fall back, we need OBJ to pick up the slack of Landry being out. That's why he's coming back.
Speaking of that game, it looks like Andy Dalton's going to miss that one. So the Texans are seeing their rookie quarterback make his first ever start in the NFL. Looks like Justin Fields will make his first ever start of the Chicago Bears on Sunday against Cleveland. If you're looking for some defenses out on the waiver wire in fantasy football, I'm playing Cleveland. I don't trust rookie quarterbacks. I haven't loved what I see with the scene with Justin Fields. I mean, Carolina, too. Like, I was picking up tons of Carolina, tons of Cleveland today. I want heavy exposure on both of those fantasy football defenses against rookie quarterbacks, so I don't think either one of them are ready.
I mean, look at it. Zach Wilson, yeah, he had one good week. But you know what? Even if you say it's a 50-50 chance, it's weighted in your favor because the chances are more likely a rookie quarterback fails against an experienced NFL defense. And if you look at Trevor Lawrence, he still hasn't put it together yet. And if you look at Trey Lance, he's just filling in on certain packages, but he hasn't set the world on fire. Otherwise, Jimmy G'd be sitting down. And from Fields' perspective and all the Bears fans that were just clamoring for him to be in the game, when Dalton, just similar to what we saw here with Davis Mills, when Dalton went out and Fields knew he was going to be the guy, he did not wow anybody or knock anybody's socks off saying, this is my job now and I'm not giving it up. So you're right in doing what you're doing. And from a perspective of the Browns, it's an ideal situation for them defensively. But offensively, they still know the Bears defense can not only do some things to stop progress of offenses, they can put points on the board. They can create turnovers. They've got a front seven that can wreak havoc. And that's something that with Baker Mayfield, you know when he is pressured, you know that when he's in panic mode, he has the tendency to cough it up. So you have to have as much as you can on offense to load up, and then you got to be prepared for, as bad as their offense could be in Chicago, you have to be prepared for a defense that's in the upper echelon of defenses in this league.
Justin Fields, the number 11 pick of this past draft. Deshaun Watson was the number 12 pick, if memory serves, in his draft. Dwayne Haskins was the 15th pick of the 2019 draft. More likely career trajectory for Justin Fields, Deshaun Watson or Dwayne Haskins?
Oh, I think Deshaun Watson. I think that there was a lot of swing and miss in Dwayne Haskins, and thanks to the Steelers, there's a lot of immaturity, too. I mean, with Justin Fields, just look at the comments he made about Andy Dalton when everybody was clamoring for him to start, and the way he was, whether he meant it or not, but the way he was able to, you know, downplay it and say, hey, look, we all need to support him. You don't need to boo him. He's been great to me, and I want him to succeed, and, you know, and we're all in this together kind of thing. Whereas Dwayne Haskins, from the get-go, he was pissed off that he didn't get drafted in the top five or six. He was pissed off when he got to the Redskins and figured that the job should have been his with no one other consideration. Then when he started to fail, he was pointing fingers at everybody else. He was taking selfies on the damn sidelines while the game's still going on, but you want to believe he's a mature quarterback that deserves to be, you know, in control of the situation and given more responsibilities. BS. He's lucky the Steelers gave him a second opportunity. He's probably going to get a chance now with Roethlisberger being dinged up to at some point see what he could do. But if he doesn't prove himself this time, he's not going to be in the league very long. Justin Fields already has done enough and athletically has enough that he's going to be around for a while.
Yeah, if he can ever beat out Mason Rudolph for that backup job there in Pittsburgh. Maturity is one of the biggest attributes to me for a quarterback, and I think it's a good point by you. I need to see more from Justin Fields, though, and it's too early to start making like definitions on what a player is going to be over the course of his career, but haven't seen a whole lot from him so far. And again, very, very small sample size. This from the Pro Football Hall of Fame, Texans receiver, former Texans receiver Andre Johnson, one of 122 nominees for the 2022 Class of Pro Football Hall of Fame. This is Andre's first year of eligibility. They trim it down to a semifinalist, and they trim it down to finalist, and then they vote to see if they'll be in the Hall of Fame. Andre Johnson, no doubt, Hall of Famer, but they never give receivers in on the first ballot. Like, it usually takes a while. Look at Terrell Owens. Took him forever. Now, the media hated him, but Andre Johnson's not going to make it this year.
Yeah, no, the thing to me is that Texan, he's in the Texans Hall of Fame, slam dunk, first ballot, maybe the greatest Texan of all time, along with J.J. Watt. You can go over and over again. Is it his fault, as we go back to the first segment of the show, or the second segment of the show, is it his fault that he never really had good quarterbacks throwing to him, with the exception of a couple years of Matt Schaub? Because that's what's going to be held against him. If he had a decent to above average quarterback for the majority of his career, his numbers could have been even better. So the fact that everybody from a player standpoint respected and raved about what a great player he was, whether they got him the ball the right way or enough or not, means he's going to get in. As opposed to Eli Manning, who is riding in, you know, being in the league long enough to run up some stats, which still aren't great stats, but because he has two Super Bowls and two MVPs in those Super Bowls, people think he's a slam dunk to get in the Hall of Fame. It's a tale of two different players. One, totally great, but was basically not given a whole lot around him, as opposed to the other one, who was given everything around him and then reaped the benefits of a total team effort that was good enough to win two Super Bowls, and he did what he had to do. David Tyree's catch on the helmet might be as responsible for one of his MVP trophies, too. But you know what? You can't be mad at a guy that's a victim of circumstance and it goes his way. You're right. He's going to get in. I just don't think it's going to be right away first ballot.
You know what helps out Eli? He's a Manning.
The fact it doesn't hurt.
The fact that he's a Manning, like if he was Philip Rivers or whatever.
You know what else helps Eli? The fact that the old school, out of date voting, the way that the NFL ballots are handled for Hall of Fame, means that the Manning name and the fact that they go into a freaking ballroom in a hotel and someone's got to sing your praises and then have other guys go ahead and, you know, try and put holes, punch holes in it, and then they debate it a little bit. That's the BS, old school, way out of date way that the NFL does it with politics.
Uh-huh.
So that helps Eli. And because he played in New York, won in New York, and got those awards for New York, those are going to be the biggest honks that from a national media perspective are going to want Eli in the Hall of Fame.
If he was a Joe Smith in Cincinnati that did it, probably not.
Probably
Eli
not.
Manning in New York, I'm right there with you. Coming up next, 12-team playoff in college football. Does it still make sense after realignment? That's next. Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
You going to answer that?
To call into the HRNP listener line, dial 713-780-ESPN. The Affordable Care Act continues to be a complex regulation, and employers must comply. Visit HRP.net for help. You're listening to The Killer Bees with Joel Blank and Jeremy Branham on ESPN 97.5 and 92.5, broadcasting live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios.
All right, 12-team playoff. Is it still the way for college football? Whenever they expand the playoffs, if you believe they are going to expand the playoffs in college football, which, by the way, where do you stand on that? Do you want expansion when it comes to your playoffs in college football?
I do. And I debated this with the Blitz forever and a day. I see their point of not wanting to go to 12. I want at least 8 because I believe that it's the most fair system to make sure that if you are the Cinderella team, that you at least get the opportunity to show that you are or you aren't, and you don't just get left on the outside looking in because of conferences and because of a committee and biases and some computer program. I think that 12 is probably too much, and it really starts to hinder your overall schedules, your conference schedules, especially with the SEC and now probably having to go to an extended schedule. I think 12's too much, but 8's enough to make sure that you don't screw over that kind of wild card Cinderella team from year to year.
Houston, where do you stand on the playoff? How many teams would you like to see in it? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. I'm obviously for expansion. I think college football being the only sport in the entire world where every team that plays in its league does not have a chance to win its title is flat out stupid. Like, that's a stupid concept. Like, how have we gone on so long where that is something that makes sense? Every other sport in the entire world, you at least have the opportunity to win that sports championship, with the exception of college football.
But, Jeremy, it's also about the mighty dollar, right? The NCAA, for as sure. backward-ass as they've been, know that their biggest cash cow is March Madness.
Uh-huh.
So if they just kind of, aside from the TV deals, just realized, hey, look, if we canceled like the small school early in the season games that a lot of these big-time teams are playing, and we realized that we just backloaded it to the end for the playoff, the money that we'd reap in from national TV, from the actual events and where they're being held and the hype around it and all that other stuff, you're going to just rake in more cash.
I would totally get rid of every bowl and go to a 12-team playoff. And, like, the idea that the 12 teams is too much, like, we don't want to see these matchups where Alabama's playing, like, I don't know, Cincinnati, whatever. Yeah, you do. Like, you're betting on Maction on a Tuesday night. Like, yeah, you want to see more football. More football is a good thing, and it's not a diminished product. You're getting more games with teams that are ranked in the top 12. Like, that is exciting. That is good for college football. I never understood the argument with, no, I don't want to see that matchup, but you're going to be betting on Wisconsin-Notre Dame this weekend.
Well, easy. But here's the thing. I mean, for big picture, when you start looking at it, do I really want, when you start looking at the complexion of the bowl schedule from the last couple of years, to be bowl eligible, you just have to basically be 500. You have teams that are teetering on losing records that are getting into bowl games that no one really wants to watch, no matter what else is on television on a given night during the holiday season. You'd much rather see, whether it be a sleeper team that's basically kind of fooled everybody and run the table this year and deserves a chance, before you get to the big Goliaths of the world taking each other on in what the current system is with the two semifinals and the final, the chance for you to have meaningful football in those bowl games as opposed to two teams that squeaked in by the skin of their teeth and because of their conference got into the Car-X Muffler Bowl or whatever the hell it is, the Beer Cheese Soup Bowl.
Right.
Who wants to see that?
Now, I shouldn't have said I'd get rid of the bowl system, because I would keep the bowl system. I would just change when they're played. Instead of playing them at the end of the regular season, I'd make all of those my week zero games. So you still have like your tie-ins. You still have the Big Ten versus it's not the Pac-10 anymore, but you still have that Rose Bowl, and you still have the Parade of Roses, except you do it in week zero of the next college football season. You wipe off all the postseason bowls, and you put this 12-team college playoff together. That's never going to happen. I understand logistically that would never happen. It's my dream of college football. But 12 teams to me makes sense. The Notre Dame athletic director, Jack Swarbrick, and 10 FBS commissioners meeting today in Chicago, talking about what they're going to do or what they want to do eventually. The SEC and Notre Dame would not vote for an 8-team playoff that has automatic qualifiers, whereas the G5 wouldn't vote for one that doesn't. So there's a little bit of a conflict right now on 8 teams. It sounds like 12 is probably the number that they will eventually agree to. And then Swarbrick, again, the Notre Dame athletic director, says, I have absolutely no doubt the playoff will expand. When it will expand and what the exact format will be, I don't know, but they will expand. I think conference realignment probably pushed back the expansion of college football playoffs probably a year to 3 years. I don't think we're going to see it as fast as we would have if we didn't see Texas and Oklahoma bolt to the SEC, the Big 12 doing their thing. So I think that's probably going to kick the can down the road on college football playoff expansion. I do ultimately think it gets there, and I do ultimately think the number is 12.
Dell, you're the college football expert. I always want your opinions on this as well, because people should be listening to that show on the weekends too, because that's the go-to formula.
What's
for
the name
college
of the show,
football.
Joel?
It's a Dell on Sports.
No, that's not the name of the show.
I've always said, look, 8, 12 might be overkill. A lot of people say, well, it's just to get more SEC teams in. I don't think so, but either way, I just want to expand the playoff.
I'm a fan of expansion. I'm not really sure on the number. 12 seems fun to me, partly because I'm not sure why the top level of the sport needs to be so dramatically different from all the other levels below it. Jeremy talks about how college football is the only sport that does it. Actually, it's only Division One, and not even Division One. Division One FBS is the only one who does it this way. For whatever reason, people love to lean on, this is this is what we've always done. This is what college football is about. No, only FBS is what this is about. Through North Dakota State, which produced all those quarterbacks, all those titles they won, they didn't just get voted into the playoff. They had to win their way in. I'm a fan. I think 12 is fun. As far as how they decide those teams, I'm not sure about that, but I would like more campus home games.
Yeah, I would love the first two rounds to be on campus. Like, you, if whether you have like the 9, 10, 11, 12, if they play in the first round to get to 8, you have those at home, and then you have that first round where all the teams that had byes, they get that first home campus game too. I think that'd be awesome. And the reason that I say 12 and not 8, like, I would love both, but I think 12 politically is what it's going to get down to, and we just saw that right there with the SEC and Notre Dame wouldn't vote for an 18 playoff that doesn't that has automatic qualifiers. G5 wouldn't. I think the compromise there is 12. What do you think, Houston? 713-780-ESPN, 713-780-3776. Let's go to the HR&P listener line. Jay, you're in the Hive with the Killer Bees.
How you doing tonight, fellas?
What's up, Jay?
So would it have been a terrible idea to use that the BCS system with the computers and then the playoff format? I mean, that way you take out the human element of the voters panel. I mean, because they have ultimately alma maters and everything like that. Would that have not been a good idea?
I don't hate the idea. I think both systems are flawed. I think you do have personal, like, human bias whenever you take the computers away. Like, to me, it should be a combination of both, and I think that's what the BCS was, so that makes sense. Like, to Dell's point, I want to see more like qualifiers to get into the tournament. Like, I don't think that they want to put like the Power Five like moniker out there to be like where if you win one of those Power Five conferences, you're given an automatic spot. I know that the first time that this was kicked around before college football realignment was they just said the top five conference champions. So whoever is determining that, whether it's the college football playoff committee, whether they add these computer rankings, all they said were the top five college – actually, they said top six. You can change it now to top five if you want. But they said the top five, top six college football conference champions get an automatic spot. I think that that's perfect. Now you're adding qualifiers to it. Qualifiers are what it should take to get into a postseason. Every other sport has qualifiers, whether it's winning your division, winning your conference, being, you know, the best wild card team because of record. You need to have qualifiers in place to get into it. That way everybody has a chance at that. If there's 12, I don't really care at what point – like, if it's computers, whether it's humans, because at that point, at least you've now, like, earned the right to be there. If you go undefeated, you're going to be there. You're going to have a chance to play for the championship. So I don't really care about, like, the computers or the humans deciding these wild card teams that are in. Just put the qualifiers in there where if you go undefeated, basically, you have a chance to win the sports championship.
Yeah, because here's the thing. When you get the personal – we talk about bubble teams in the NCAA tournament. Bubble teams are determined as much by personal bias as they are from any computer. And that's where you run into trouble because you're already going to have conferences not named the SEC going, well, wait a minute. We know that, what you're talking about, each conference champion is guaranteed the berth in, right? But now they're going to start going, well, why does the SEC get three other teams in the final remaining slots? Why do we only get one or two? Or, you know, and there's going to be all that bickering that's going to continue to go on. And the personal bias is just going to actually make it worse because the personal bias, if it's coming from the commissioner of a said conference or a guy that has ties to a said university that was in a said conference, he may be skewed a little bit in the way he makes his opinion known. So it muddles the whole process up. That's why I would never go anywhere past 12. I still think 12 might be a little watered down.
Yeah.
Because you also don't want people fighting over teams that have no shot at winning it anyway because they were the third best team in a certain conference.
Right, but there's that also allows for the team who like gets hot late too.
Sure.
You know, like a team who maybe was without their starting quarterback early in the season, got off to a 1-2 start, and then all of a sudden they're red hot down the stretch. Maybe they qualify for that last 12 spot in the playoff because maybe at that time they're one of the best four or five teams in the entire country. In terms of determining the wild card, like I see points for both of it. Like, you don't want the computers to do all the talking. You want to also get rid of the personal bias. But at that point, like, I don't care because if you win the conference and you're one of the top five conference champions in the country, you're going to the playoff anyways. So now the decisions and who you're leaving out are teams that they're not going to have a great argument. Like, right now in this current system, Cincinnati goes undefeated this year. They finish fifth in the country. Like, that's a hard discussion to have. Hey, you're not going to be in the college football playoff because you're 12-0. Now you get down to teams 13 and 14 who are on the bubble and miss it. Just to your point, like with college basketball, team 69, 70, 71, those teams don't have a great case. There's a reason they're 69, 70, 71. There's a reason in college football you'd be the 13th, 14th, 15th teams. you're not going to really have a leg to stand on. It means you probably lost
but
two or three
games.
But
to your point on the hot team, the one thing that you can say is you might have endured injuries during the start of the season that really set you back. But late in the season, you got healthy, you got on a roll, everybody's playing, and you don't want to screw that team either because that team has proven that they have enough talent overall.
Yep.
That it's going to be hard to send them home.
And then to that point, too, like, who's factoring that in? If you're going with computers, are they factoring in hot teams with momentum and then the human element where there's biases? So there's probably not a perfect answer to determine those wild card teams, but at least at that point, you're arguing for teams way down, you know, the ladder there in college football. Coming up next, Ken Hoffman of Sports Map has an idea to keep Carlos Correa in Houston. What it is next, Killer Bees on ESPN 97.5 and ESPN 92.5.
Hey, right now, I want to tell you about Doc Linville. Dude really changed my life with the NeoGraft hair process that I just went through this last weekend. I was skeptical going in because I didn't know anything about it. And I had heard about all the other ways that people were trying to get their hair back, and they weren't natural. And it was just so many different things that just turned me off to even considering the fact that I didn't have a forehead anymore. I had an 8-head. But I met with Doc Linville. I talked to John Granato, who couldn't say enough positive things about how pleased he was with the process, the results he got, and the fact that Doc Linville was the best in the business to do it. So I went and met with Doc. And after meeting with him, I was convinced more than ever that this was for me. And I went through the process, and it was literally painless on Saturday. And the ladies that took care of me, that work for Doc Linville, they're the ones that when this was first getting going, were traveling the country to do this procedure. Now they work for him. They do it right here in Houston, and they can do it for you. And the best part about it is you guys can see if you're a good candidate. Just go to 975hair.com, and then you can get a free consultation, which is normally $150, with Doc Linville and his staff to see if you are a candidate so that you can benefit from this process. Because I have. I did it. I'm excited, and I want you guys to be a part of it, too. Because, you know, I don't speak for anything I don't believe in, and I'm a believer in this process. I can't wait to see the full results. They say it'll be 6 to 9 months before the true thickness of the hair comes in. But even now, when you see my new hairline and the fact that you know I have a legitimate forehead again instead of an 8-head, you realize that there is something to this. It's your own hair. They're just relocating it to the places where you need it, and they take care of you every step of the way. They care, and the human element is so fully customized with each individual that signs up for it, and their staff is better than anybody I've ever met. Financing's available, but like I said, get that free consultation for ESPN listeners, which is normally $150, and see if you qualify. It's a life changer, it's a game changer, and I'm glad I did it. You should check it out.
ESPN 97.5.